Hey everyone, it's Nate with a private service announcement. How you doing? I hope you're well wherever you are. I've got another interview for you, and it's with Noah Miller, the man who left Victoria, left the island, and moved to my hometown of Calgary. I don't even know why. Well, in the year 2020, distance is no object, so because of the internet, we got this interview still going. We started our conversation by talking about him in his life as a dog owner. His cute little puppy named Sansa can be a cute little handful. And because he's also a program manager in his residential living job, I kind of wondered if there was any skills that bled over between the two. And so he gives a really interesting answer based on my kind of weird question, but it was kind of fun. You'll want to hear what he has to say there. And then we talk about his academics, and because, I mean, this guy basically is always in school. He has multiple degrees. He finished his first degree, and I mean, I'm going into my first master's program, but he's already bagged one, and he's looking at his second master's degree. It's super, super inspiring for me. And on top of that, he's got himself an academic paper all published up. He is a published author, this guy. And better yet, the conversation that is the main focus of that published paper, we talked about it, and it was really, really timely considering all the discussions in our society right now about discrimination and racism. He was invited into an Indigenous community near the Fraser Valley, where they got to identify some projects that they wanted to share with historians and documenters like himself. It was super, super intriguing the way that he went about that, and very, very timely in terms of a conversation about stuff that's happening in our world right now. So outside of the conversation about work and education stuff, we talk a little bit about the things that have been giving him life during COVID. The fact that his picture that he took of me, one of the pictures he took of me for a UVic photo contest, made me another poster boy. I totally forgot about this one, but he chats about it in the episode. And on top of that, we just kind of end our conversation with some of the things we hope we regain post-COVID in our society, namely warmth between people. You know what, instead of everybody turning the cold shoulder because, well, COVID restrictions, you're supposed to have your distance and have your personal space and all that rubbish. I know we're doing it for safety, but still, I'm such a people person, and I like hugs, and I say hi to everybody. And well, Noah's saying that I'm not the only one that's been experiencing people not smiling back, not saying hi, and trying to respect our space. You know what, say hi to me back. Anyway, I digress. We had a sweet conversation. I enjoyed every minute of it, and I hope that you enjoy this episode too. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy today's private service announcement. So thank you, Jesus, for another day and another great interview today with my friend Noah Miller. Thanks for what we get to talk about today, and that we would get to chat about some stuff that maybe we've never talked about before and get to know each other in a new way. Amen.
Amen, my dude.
So, Noah, sometimes luck brings people together. Other times it's fate. For us, it was Lifetime Networks. Since that fateful fall morning when we shook hands on our first work shift together, our stories became forever intertwined. Just ask Mariah or anyone we used to share workspace with, the bromance was strong. But I must say, all jokes aside, getting to unravel the mysteries of Mr. Miller, from multiple careers to your academic pursuits to adventuring and much more, it's all left me with a great feeling of respect for you. And so I'm super stoked to get the chance to interview you on my podcast today, my man. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me, Nate.
So I want to start by saying, along your journey, you've worked as a frontline support worker with vulnerable populations. You've held nonprofit middle management positions. And you've led full-time 24/7 government-funded respite operations. Each role has had its challenge and its benefits. But recently, you took on a whole new kind of full-time job. You adopted a puppy. Sansa is the cutest little pup, and I hear also quite the handful. Yes. So both people and animal care, both people and animal care responsibilities on your resume. How does being a dog owner and being a program manager require both similar and different managerial skills?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, as far as similarities go, I definitely think, you know, having the old weekly performance review with how little pup's doing is definitely a little bit helpful. In all seriousness, a lot of things like, you know, tapping into that positive encouragement, definitely reinforcing when things aren't going well. So, you know, when I find my shoe in bed with me mysteriously, you know, very appropriately expressing what the heck is going on. Let's correct this somehow and then kind of go from there. It might include me walking to my closet in the middle of the night, showing her where it lives and kind of going from there. Obviously, you know, humans and our pets sometimes learn a little bit differently. So I'm not actually sitting down for a half hour. This is the parts of your performance that aren't acceptable kind of chat. But yeah, I don't know.
Although you've definitely done that.
Oh yeah, we tried it. She spaced down about 30 seconds in and just started staring at the treat bag over my right shoulder. So, so I guess I've seen that happen with Timbits in actual meetings as well. So I don't know, maybe it isn't that different.
Yeah. You know, I mean, positive reinforcement for a dog and positive reinforcement for a human, they can't be too far off. One gets a bone and one wants a pay raise.
Just pay of different kind.
But yeah, I mean, it's must be rewarding. I mean, what is rewarding about it for you?
Yeah, I think the rewarding thing about both those kind of hats is getting to play like a key role in watching someone learn. And I think that's so cool to be able to see this little pup go from, you know, not even able to hold her pee when she's walking across the carpet to, you know, like listening to commands, jumping through hoops, that sort of thing. So I don't know. It's interesting. It's a lot of fun and makes me really proud to watch and be a part of. I don't know. It's cool.
I like that. I also like that apparently Santa isn't peeing on your carpet, holding it.
Me too.
That's enough.
Cannot wait to move.
No kidding. Is it going to be an adventure pup?
Yeah, for sure. Right now, I'm kind of going through the first step of having her registered as a therapy dog. There's a series of tests she has to go through and pass, and I don't expect she'll nail it first time through. She's still a puppy. I want to be kind of realistic with my expectations, but, you know, she's at the point now where she's hiking 10K at a time with me, and we're looking into making the little fur ball a hunting dog.
Hey,
yeah.
Gonna go catch your grouse, pick it out of the ground after you shoot it down, kind of thing. Like, scare off bears. Yep. Sansa is like up to like halfway up my shin. Like, Sansa's a small dog.
Yeah, she's maybe 15 pounds. That being said, man, she's smart. Like, the other day I was playing keep away with her, and you know, I was running the other direction, and she like tackled the back of my knees and took me out. So, you know, it ain't the size, it's how you use it.
Clearly. What's one of the skills that you've learned through being in the job that was, I don't know, that's been a staple of what you do every day now?
I'd say patience. I don't think that quite captures it. I think, you know, maybe the ability to remain calm or find that kind of zen, even when things are going sideways. You know, I woke up from a nap just maybe half an hour ago, and there was a toilet paper roll absolutely destroyed in my living room. And you just kind of get to a point where you're able to look at it, laugh, and say, okay, yeah, we'll clean this up. And I think that applies too, you know, if you find yourself in situations where maybe emergency first aid is required, or, you know, things are pretty sketch-a-letch, we'll put it that way. That you kind of, you know, you don't necessarily laugh about it, but you kind of look at the situation, okay, yeah, well, let's move on, let's respond as appropriate and kind of go from there.
Kind of roll with the punches.
Yep, exactly.
In terms of education, and academia more generally, you've completed more than one degree from various universities. You're eyeing up a master in social work to round out your collection, but you've already bagged an MA and published an academic paper. Tell me a bit about the draw of continuing education for you.
Mm-hmm. I think it's that kind of similar. As much as I like seeing other people learn, I love to learn myself. There's always been something that kind of scratches my drive when it comes to learning. It's been different things at different points. You know, during my undergraduate degree, I did kind of like a pre-law program. I became really interested in stuff like the law and mental health. You know, decided, you know, I wasn't quite fully satisfied with what I had explored there. Looked into a master's program that kind of addressed the same similar topics, and you know, at the same time realized that, you know, I really like teaching and stuff as well. So did a postgrad certificate in educational psychology, and now I'm kind of at the point where I've put it all together. I like working with people. I like learning new skills and teaching new skills. I like working in kind of the human services sector, and so that's led me to the natural point where I'm doing a master of social work.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of marrying all the different pieces and turning it into something applicable in a new kind of way, because you've already been using everything that you have education-wise gone through, but this is going to allow something like a new door to be open, right?
Yeah, I'm able to, like, I think I have a lot of overlap with the world of social work already. I think I'm just more interested in having the opportunity to build my clinical skills and, you know, being able to like formally do counseling and that sort of thing. So
similar to kind of where I'm feeling in terms of wanting to do my master's just to get my clinical skills to a new level. There's a piece of me that I know I have to do my master's so that I can even get through the door of like this, a new position working as a clinical registered clinical counselor or whatever. So I know that there's those pieces that I have to jump through the hoop of going through the master's, but honestly, when it comes down to like, I'm already so overlapping with professional counselors. I'm in conversations with them about shared clientele, and I kind of just want to be able to make the jump over and do that clinical work myself. I think that's, it's just the progression of my career as I'm looking forward to the next step.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you find this too, but often, you know, when you're kind of in different work scenarios, do you find that often you're using those kind of skills informally?
Most definitely. When I'm in non-professional spaces, the things that I've learned through my profession, through working with people, which you totally understand, is it's more of like a almost like a lifestyle shift of how I interact with people, that it's kind of hard to switch that off. It's, to be honest, the way that you interact with somebody who is going through an emotional crisis or somebody that you know that's having a rough day, I'm not going to somehow take off my empathy hat and be like, oh yeah, that sucks. It's just like so blunt, and that doesn't work for me. And so I don't know, there's a piece of me that also wants to be able to refine what I do in a professional setting to a whole new level. And I think that is my main draw to that next step of education. And I mean, that sounds exactly like what you're saying for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say that's pretty similar.
What about the academic paper? So what's that like? I mean, having that published, was that just a natural part of your master's, or how did that come about?
Yeah, I think when I started grad school, that was one of the kind of the bars I set for myself, is I wanted to publish something somewhere reputable, not like somewhere I was putting on, you know, my website or something like that. And so I kind of was looking for opportunities or topics that might be worthy of my time. it was interesting. There was a field school on offer at UVic, and it was paired with a community I actually used to live in up the Fraser Valley. And it was essentially a multi-month project where you'd go on the invitation of an Indigenous community and work on projects that they identified as of interest to them and of interest in working with historians on. So that absolutely changed kind of what I wanted to do academically. It wasn't a theory paper. You were going, meeting people, doing oral interviews with elders who had lived through things like residential schools or part of Canada's racially segregated healthcare system back in the 50s and so on. So
just wondering then, is it a little bit of a biography then?
In what sense?
The accumulating of the different stories and different experiences, like what in the end was the finished product of what you were publishing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically I took interviews I'd performed with folks, and you know, they had shared a number of perspectives on their experience with healthcare in BC, and you know, what that looked like for them in terms of its relationship with stuff like colonization and that sort of thing. So you know, that lots of feedback. I think the original draft went through probably 3 years of revisions with, you know, experts in the field, conferences, community members themselves, and you know, that stone was eventually polished down into something that you know, an old professor of mine was kind enough to put in a book of his. So
that's so interesting. I find that particularly interesting in the political climate we're in right now, around all this conversation about our racialized nation and racism in general in the States, in Canada, across the world. This conversation is so huge right now. When you look back at this piece, that's so much about the experience of these Indigenous peoples that invited you in to do this work, their colonization experiences and all that. What's that like when you look back at that from today's perspective?
Yeah, it's incredibly humbling. I think, you know, one of the key takeaways, this wasn't necessarily a focus of the paper, but one of the key things that kind of forced me to reflect was, you know, that we had this system of, you know, this dual medical system where one's kind of it fully segregated, basically, based on the belief that, you know, there was this kind of racial problem that needed to be treated separately, despite the fact that, you know, settler society basically created the conditions which caused people to become sick in the first place, right? So, yeah, I think it's just very humbling and kind of, you know, it gives perspective on, you know, not only my own privilege in terms of, you know, my position in society today, but also, you know, the ways in which, you know, I need to kind of give a hard look at how, I play a part in, you know, maybe more systemic issues that consciously or unconsciously, are ongoing. Yeah.
Well said. It's humbling right now, actually, for me to think about the experience that's being shared by people that even live in my city. Maybe they're not Black folk, but people who experience racism, hearing the stories and hearing that my experience is just mine. It's different than so many others. And there's been some people that have gone through some very overt, very painful and harmful, malicious, racist experiences. And there's that historical piece for any Indigenous folk living in our city and in our nation. Yeah, totally. Humbling is a really good word for it, because, and maybe eye-opening would be added to that, because what do you do when you feel like there's so much in front of you? It's so big, it's so overwhelming, but you do kind of have to take those little steps. And it's a conversation that's not over. Honestly, it's not going to be over anytime soon.
And I think sometimes too, it's not a conversation that's as distant as us, as from us as we'd like to think. I know, even doing my research, like it, of course I was writing about the 1950s and 60s, but I encountered a lot of folks who, you know, they described in detail how the police would pick them up, drive them 60, 70 miles out of town and leave them. So, you know, they'd have to walk back home, and I don't know about you, but that's a long walk. And, it's a jarring reminder that, you know, we're not far removed from this because we're north of the border or, you know, a couple years removed from, you know, more overt, actually that's pretty overt itself, but, a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So back to the question about the education piece, then having all of this wrapped into kind of the way you approach your work, getting a master's in social work or whatever step you find yourself in next, does this all change the way that you approach schooling, or is it still kind of, you know, I want to grow my skills so that I can just do this work in the new field?
I'm sure it's a bit of both. Like, I'm not going to pretend I'm completely selfless and doing this for everyone else. I don't think I'm quite there. I'm going to be honest about that. At the same time, like I do think, you know, part of my driving philosophy is to ask the question, you know, like, who does whatever situation benefit, right? And so there's kind of an anti-oppression kind of interest that has always kind of followed me through all those disciplines. It's a bit of a common thread, but you know, whether that's intentional or not, I'll leave that for someone else to judge.
Just have to do our work and people can think what they need to, and we'll just keep rolling. So my friend, out of all the work that you've done, I guess it would be hard to boil down what it is that you're most proud of, but I know from my experience in watching the way you do your work when we're doing Lifetime Network stuff, or hearing about your experience with education, getting through your last master's, and you got through a ton of really, really impressive steps in that academic journey. Excellence is kind of what I think of when I think of the work that you've done and the work that I hope to also do, kind of like that when I get through a master's finally. Despite your work and your school and all those pieces of like the more professional side of your life, you're not just a hardworking nerd, my friend. You're actually fun, bro. I don't know if anybody's ever said that to you, but you know what? You're a fun guy, my friend. I mean, correct this list if I'm wrong, but in no particular order, you hike in camp. Yeah. You're a killer photographer. Your beer making game is now on point. Most importantly, you enjoy a good George Lucas special. Shout out to Star Wars. any of these topics, we could talk about all of them. Some of these activities for you have been affected by COVID-19 restrictions, more like the hiking and getting around and stuff. And you have other interests that have grown through quarantine. So of these hobbies, what scratches your creative itch best, and what satisfies your self-care needs the most?
I definitely think, like, in terms of what scratches that creative itch the most, definitely the photography side of things. I'm part of a club here in Calgary that gives incredible feedback. You know, they meet twice a month. They talk about, you know, photography as an art form, and you kind of share some of what you've worked on with them, and they give you kind of feedback about, you know, like, this is really great. Like, what are you going for? How can we can like advance that a little bit further? And like, it's amazing. You know, I don't think of my photography as that great or anything. But I do, it is kind of neat to look back even a couple of years and see, you know, how I used to look at things, and now be able to very in a tangible way kind of see how that's shifted. And you know, in each little kind of technique that I've picked up from someone, I can kind of see their influence on what I've done differently. And yeah, I don't know, it's really interesting.
I think you're talking not just post-production, you're also talking about like how you compose a shot. Yeah. And
Yeah, I mean, right. Lightroom and Photoshop for sure, but you know, like when you're out shooting, like how can you achieve a different effect with, you know, whether you're adjusting your shutter speed, your aperture, or anything like that? Yeah, yeah, it's fun.
So the photography piece is around that like more creative itch.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I still have a bit of a competitive side. Like I do like to enter photo contests in the odd time, as you'll know, Nate, you remember a couple of years back, you were not only the face of child and youth care at UVic, you were also, the face of UVic recruiting.
That's so, I actually forgot that one, but that was the picture you took of me on our hike at, Caleb Pike, Jocelyn Hill. That's that right. One.
Yeah. Overlooking that,
the know, little the island, whatever, yep. Yeah, across from Malahat. Beautiful picture. That's right. That was for the recruiting center.
Yep. The world at UVic was the caption.
Did it won, right?
I can't remember.
It was one of the like three pictures or something like that.
Yeah, it was
like,
one of the top ones. I don't know.
Just another picture made on the website. I mean, come on.
Man, the Alumni Association must love you.
Dude, I'm known. So we got that creative itch side. What about that self-care needs side from what you've been doing, activities, hobbies, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, I'm someone who loves cooking. It's a massive outlet for me. You know, I definitely fell into this craze of baking during COVID. Like if you don't want to go inside, it's not quite there. All right, well, venture down to your local supermarket and buy the only bag of flour left that weighs like 45, 50 pounds. Yeah.
Yep.
Still going strong. But no, I just, no. I love, you know, I think I take great pride in being able to, you know, show something or share something with people I care about that's been made from scratch. Like that, you know, I didn't just go to the store and buy, but like, hey, I did this from beginning to end, like whether that's beer or bacon bread or cookies or whatever that might look like. I don't know. It feels good. And,
so,
you know,
what have you made?
Yeah. I've made a couple beers. I made a red ale, during COVID. It's there's a bottle on your way to right now onto you. Oh, on its way to you right now, dude. I promise I haven't had any during this interview. yeah. And then, just this past week, I cracked open a bottle of my batch of Saison. So, had a couple beers that have been made.
How was that?
It turned out much better than I expected. I've, you know, I've had some family members, granted they're a biased source, say that it's the best homebrew they've ever had. So I don't know. We'll maybe let that, leave that to you to decide.
And I will decide very, very soon. I am very, very stoked for that.
I feel a spinoff coming on here, Nate.
We're going to have to do the drink review time because you're going to be sipping on our family's grape cider, which I'll trade to Mary.
Okay,
and I'll have the Saison or the red ale or whatever is on the menu for next time.
Not we'll have bad. To exchange notes for sure. But yeah, I'm coming back to your question about, you know, like what fills my bucket, to put it that way. Like for me, like hiking is number one, like getting out and adventuring, even driving roads I've never been down. I think, you know, there's just something so exhilarating about being somewhere you've never been or seeing sights you've never seen. And like, man, we're right next to Canmore and Kananaskis here. And you know, those mountains, they're so breathtaking to be able to just drive, you know, like an hour and a bit and be at the foot of these towering things is really something. And, you know, coming home after a long day of adventure and putting some food in your belly and having that like tired feeling, you know, when you can't keep your eyes open because you're so like satisfied and exhausted from walking. It's my favorite feeling. I would not trade that for anything.
I feel you on so many levels with that, like going and exploring things and places that I haven't been. And actually, now that I think back, there's probably been more weekends during COVID, like since mid-March, that I've gone out in that space of what? It's been 3 months or so, March, April, May, June, July, 3.5 months or more, than maybe that same stretch of time in the previous year or two. Like, I have been out and I've been trying to get that self-care in as much as possible. And getting up island here in Vancouver Island, it's there's still a lot of places for me left to explore and check out I know exactly what that's like. You can sit down. For me, I like laying in my hammock and just like sinking into it because I'm tired and it's like this contentedness.
Yeah, I know the feeling. And it's so interesting too, because if you look at like any individual trip and like, you know, there's always like, oh, I'm not quite comfortable in my tent, or, you know, I didn't get the best sleep. My eyes are burning from the camera. It doesn't matter. Like anything that kind of goes a little bit wrong, it doesn't seem like as big of a deal because there's just that pure happiness factor. And yeah, that's good.
So then for me to get out to you, what are two or three of the best ones, like the next ones on my list in your area?
Ooh. We're looking at probably Skyline Trail in Jasper. Yeah, that's up there. There's a plane wreck down in the Crow's Nest Pass. That would definitely be high up on the list. Bring your walking legs. It's about 20K, so it's going to be a long day. I don't know. I hate to say it. It's a bit of a tourist trap, but there's nothing like that view of Moraine Lake at sunrise. So that's probably the third one there.
You know what? And I have not done it yet. I do think I've gotten out into that area and had to turn around because very, very touristy. But Crow's Nest Pass has always been something that's been a place that's like a special spot for me. I've driven that a few times on the way out to Lethbridge to see friends, and in previous times have been in that area in the Kootenays. And yeah, that area is stunning to me.
Well, and especially driving through that Frank Slide area where it's just the whole mountainside is collapsed. There's nothing there and there's rocks for days. It's it's something.
You know, before we finish up the interview, I did want to ask back to COVID and back to the conversation that's been a part of pretty much an undercurrent in every conversation these days. My question for you is, what's one thing you miss about the pre-COVID days that may never be the same again?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think the one thing I miss is, you know, being friendly with strangers and not worrying about how they're going to take it. Like, I don't know about you, but when I'm walking down the sidewalk now, I definitely think twice about saying hello. I think twice about even kind of facing my head in their general direction. I tend to, you know, kind of out of respect most times, you know, just kind of face to the side and not make eye contact. And it's weird. Like it doesn't feel right to me, even though, you know, you're kind of doing your bit to keep social distance and all that. But, those random hellos or, you know, meeting new people that way is definitely missed. And, you know, if this goes on, that may be something that endures a little bit. I hope not.
That's the first time I've heard that one, but it makes so much sense. Like even in a grocery store, you're like, ooh, like I better suck myself over to this aisle so that you can get past, because like I'm trying to just respect your social spacing here. Yeah. But like saying hi to anybody, I actually actively try to say hi to as many people as I can when I'm in a space that typically could be awkward. I mean, that's just who I am. I'm trying to like break that awkward silence and like, and build a relationship with random people. Also, sometimes I think to myself, hey, can I get this person who looks like they're frowning to smile? I think that to myself, and I'm like, let's see if I can, it's got my own little game. But yeah, it's different now. It's so different now.
I find even in interactions like that, I definitely get inside my own head. Like I definitely, same boat, like want to make the person smile, but then like part of me is worried like, oh boy, what if they like, what if it goes the other way and they're like, why are you talking to me? This sort of thing. Yeah, I don't know. Another interesting thing to me is, you know, now it seems like we're hypersensitive to every little sniffle or, you know, someone clears their throat and you're like, oh God, get away from me. Like, please don't cough on my groceries or something like that. But most of the time, you know, it's, you know, someone's maybe having a hard time with their seasonal allergies, or maybe they're just not, they're feeling run down from all the stress of the last couple of months. But you read into every little symptom and you start thinking, what if this person's sick, and what if I get too close? Or so, I mean, as thinking of others as much as we are, I think it's also, you know, it's gone the other way too, where we're all very kind of worried about ourselves and our families and everyone else that we care about.
Of course. And so after it's all done, those residual effects, let's hope that people kind of bounce back to being friendly, but who knows?
Yeah. And, you know, like, hats off to people. I mean, some people are more friendly now. Like, I think there are people, I'm not saying that everyone's become miserable and Ebenezer Scrooge of the grocery store or wherever you happen to be, but it's interesting.
Not as warm and fuzzy. That's right. No hugging and kissing on the street anymore, Noah. You're not allowed to do that.
My bad.
So we're at about the end of our episode, but I just wanted to say one more time, thanks for being on with me today. You know, when we met and when we started working together, I think back to how much fun it was to have you around. And man, this is, even though you're in a different city, it's, you're close and it's special. So thank you. I'm just trying to say in a really roundabout way, thank you for being here. Thanks for being on the show and kind of following what I'm doing here. It's an honor and it's awesome.
No, thanks for having me, Nate. Massive respect for you and everything you do. So keep doing what you're doing, my friend.
Heck yeah. I can't wait for those saisons and all the red ale and all that good stuff. We'll have to do that little secondary episode or something.
Yeah. Sounds good.
All right. Take it easy, Noah. Have a good night.
All right. You too, my friend.